Hey everyone, welcome to the Delta Flyers. We are a weekly podcast that discusses episodes of Star Trek Voyager in chronological order. Your two hosts along this podcast journey are myself, Garrett Wong, aka Ensign Harry Kim, and Robert Duncan McNeil, who portrayed Lieutenant Tom Paris.
Yes, ma'am.
If you're interested in either an extended version of this podcast or the extended video version of this podcast, both of which include added bonus funny segments, check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/thedeltaflyers and sign up today to become a patron.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Robbie, you are rambunctious today.
I am a little rambunctious. Funny content, you say? Funny?
Yes.
Yes, let's do funny today. It's season two.
Yes, we're into season two. So exciting.
Yes, it is.
The episode is called The 37s.
Just a reminder to everybody. So we filmed, 21 or 22 episodes. And they decided to stop season one at 17 and save some of our episodes. So this episode, the 37s, we filmed in the first season and then we aired it in the second season. So it's a very, it's a little bit of a confusing situation.
And so that is something that we talked about that we kind of got ripped off a little bit because we should have been paid a little bit more for second season episodes.
Should have had our season two raise,
bump,
but we
our
didn't.
Bump.
Yeah,
we yeah,
didn't
we did. That. Yeah. And it was, I mean, it wasn't that much of a raise. It was like a 10% bump, I think is what it was, you know? So, a little bit of a raise.
But it was also like story-wise, I think it was confusing. I mean, for me, going back on this rewatch, mm-hmm. it's been very informative and frustrating to look back at, like, why did they stop at 17 or 16? Like, why did they stop at learning curve? Because it was never intended to be our season finale.
Correct.
And the 37s was building towards a season finale that we never actually aired. So it was a very confusing first season. And I felt that in watching, you know, rewatching some of those episodes, I felt like, why are we're kind of fizzling out here in our last couple episodes mm-hmm. in a way that seems odd. And it's because those were never intended to be the final episodes of our season. They were intended to be long before our final episodes. So 37s was intended to be building towards our finale, and it ended up being our season premiere of season two. So,
Do you think we could actually find out which episode was the actual last episode for the season one eps that we filmed? You know what I'm saying? Like, you're saying that it could, because if you're saying it was around 21 or 22, so that means really it could be season two, episode four, episode five. It'd be interesting if we could find out the exact final. Maybe Mary Howard would know this, or Brad Yacobian. We can contact those guys and ask them about that. The producers on the show that should have that information, hopefully.
Yeah, I mean, as I look back on it, it's interesting to try to figure out, because just from looking at episode one, the 37s mm-hmm. of season two, that was definitely shot in season one. Initiations, mm-hmm. episode two of season two was shot in season one. Projections, episode three, I can't remember. I'd have to go back.
Okay.
I feel like it was almost episode six. Twisted
was the finale?
Might have been the finale, or Non Sequitur, which was episode five.
Let's do our due diligence. We'll figure this out. I mean, we'll find out from somebody at some point.
Yeah, because we definitely shot a lot more episodes in season one than aired, and then used mm-hmm. some of those episodes in season two. Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. So for our Patreon patrons, we're about to play a game of What Do We Remember? And for everybody else listening to this podcast, Robbie and I are going to take a quick break to rewatch the 37s, and we will be right back with our discussion and analysis. Hey guys, we are back from our rewatch of the 37s, and we are ready to begin our discussion.
Yes, we are. Season two. Here we go. Season two.
So exciting. All right.
So here's my thoughts about season two starter. We're on a roll of very mediocre episodes. My memory, when we were doing the What Do You Remember? I was like, oh, it's a big episode. I remember Sharon Lawrence, and I forgot John Rubenstein was in this episode. John Rubenstein is a legend. Like, by the way.
Have you seen that man's resume? That is a long, long resume.
When I started as a teenager, as an actor, one of my favorite theater pieces was Pippin, the musical Pippin.
He was the lead.
He was Pippin. He played Pippin. And by the way, I've directed John Rubenstein in The Orville. I forgot he was in this episode.
Yeah.
But John Rubenstein, a phenomenal actor, a legend.
Yep. And just so everyone knows, John Rubenstein plays John Evansville, the leader of the humans that are on this planet, right?
Yes.
So yeah. He won an award for Pippin in 1972. That was directed by Bob Fosse, and in 1980 he won a Tony for Children of a Lesser God, the stage production of that. And if you look at this man's resume, literally it's longer than how tall I am, basically.
No, he's John Rubenstein is a legend as an he is an actor's actor. He has survived a career of so many different kinds of characters and in different venues in television and film and theater. Mm-hmm. I had forgotten he was in this episode, and he's one of those actors that will show up and do his job without fancy credits or, you know, anything. And that's one reason I'd forgotten he was in this. He just shows up and he does his work and he's phenomenal.
Did you remember having an interaction with him while filming this episode?
No,
did
I don't
talk to him.
I don't think so. I don't think I was in, I don't recall being in any scenes with him.
Okay.
And in fact, when I directed him in Orville a couple of years ago, I wish I had remembered that, because he played a very important role in an episode of the Orville that I directed. And I did not make the connection, and neither did he. So we spent a couple of weeks together on the Orville, and neither one of us made the connection that we had worked together.
That's funny. Well, you did share some screen time with him on this episode. He comes onto the bridge and towards the end.
Yeah.
But that's it. It's a very quick scene.
Very brief. Yeah.
But since you brought him up, let's talk about some of the other guest stars on this episode. There is an Asian American gentleman, a veteran Asian American actor of stage, film, and TV, Mr. James Saito, who's been around for quite a long time. Very nice guy. We had some conversations on the set while filming this. Very soft-spoken, very nice. Mel Winkler, who plays Jack Hayes, the farmer, the owner of that pickup truck, basically. He actually passed away June 11th of this year. So we're talking about...
Wow.
Very sad to hear. I think it was of natural causes in his sleep. Mel Winkler, rest in peace, but just recently passed
very,
away.
Very recognizable face, very familiar face. And... I thought he was wonderful. I thought all the guest stars were wonderful. Sharon Lawrence got a special credit playing Amelia Earhart in this episode.
My memory
was that she had a much larger role. As I watched the episode, I was like, oh, she didn't really do that much. I mean, she had one big scene with Janeway, but otherwise she was kind of part of the team. You know?
Yeah, she was. I my memories of Sharon were when she came onto that bridge. It was during rehearsal, and I think there was this... It was this really interesting energy. It was this energy of this mutual admiration between two actresses that were, you know, playing, you know, very iconic roles. I mean, Kate obviously playing the first female captain, and then Sharon playing the first female pilot from that era. They were admiring each other, is what it was. It was really.
I think also I know Sharon comes from the theater. Kate, I think, admired her resume. Again, because we didn't film this episode as a season premiere,
right?
I did remember it. Honestly, my takeaway was, my memory of this episode was that it was a much bigger episode than when I watched it. It was kind of a regular episode, except for the ship landing on a planet for the first time. Other than that, there was nothing particularly special or different or, you know, season premiere or finale worthy of this mm-hmm. episode. It was honestly mediocre in my opinion.
Well, okay, but better than the last two episodes of season one, I would say.
Yes, I would say it was better, and it started out better from the get-go because it involved the entire crew of our ship. Mm.
Yep.
You know, everyone was involved from the get-go, and that was something that's been missing the last couple episodes. So for those that are listening, we should recap. So we are, voyaging along in the Delta Quadrant, and we pick up some iron, I think it is. We pick up some sensor readings of iron, and everyone is shocked by that because it seems out of place in the Delta Quadrant. We haven't seen those elements before, and they find a truck floating in space from the 1930s, and they decide to land the ship on the planet, and they land and find some cryostasis chambers with a number of people from the 1930s on Earth who have been abducted. One of them is Amelia Earhart. They realize that these people were abducted and by some aliens, and that there was a rebellion from these abductees, and a whole new kind of Earth started on this planet. Voyager's crew has to decide whether they're going to stay here with these humans mm-hmm. on this kind of new emerging human planet. And ultimately, the crew is offered the choice to stay or go, and no one chooses to stay.
That's a good synopsis.
Thank you.
I didn't write a short poem for this episode, so I'll have to do it for the next one.
Okay. A haiku or something?
Yeah, the haiku. I did. I just realized I forgot to write the poem for this, but that's okay. We can do it in the next one. Or maybe I can come up with it and just...
Or you can just slam it right now. We can slam poetry, you know. Amelia Earhart on a planet. Voyager arrives. What are they going to do, damn it? Will they stay or will they go? You'll have to watch because I don't know. How's that for a poem?
Hey, I like the ending though. It was a good thing. I forgot one of the other guest stars we didn't talk about was Fred Noonan, played by David Graff. David Graff is obviously very visible or at least recognizable from the Police Academy movie series.
Yes.
And he played Tackleberry in there. And I remember being totally shocked to hear about his passing, because he passed away in April of 2001. So this is probably towards the very ending of filming of Voyager that it was announced that he passed away while he was attending a wedding with his family in Phoenix, Arizona. He was at the wedding when he had a heart attack. So very sad, because he was 9 days away from his 51st birthday.
Wow, and, young man.
And I'm 51 now, so I'm sitting here going, man. Wow. Life can be very short. You just don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. Make sure you live every day.
That's an amazing thing about this podcast we're doing, Garrett, is like going back and rewatching and recognizing some of the colleagues that we worked with, the mm-hmm. actors and the people that were involved in Voyager who have passed away. You know, we talk about some of them, some come to mind. Cosmo Genovese, our script supervisor, mm-hmm. just passed away last year. And right. Cosmo was he was on set with us. The script supervisor works with the actors to make sure we know our lines. And so the actors deal with the script supervisor quite intimately on a regular basis. And Cosmo was a great old school script supervisor who I don't think we've talked about on this podcast, but he passed away last year, and I stayed in touch with Cosmo, and I would FaceTime and send text messages and text videos to Cosmo over the years. I stayed in touch with him all the way to the end. And
I had no idea that you had that much contact with Cosmo.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Well, it was really because of the reason I stayed in touch with Cosmo, our script supervisor, was because of our stunt coordinator, Dennis Matalone. Dennis would go physically visit Cosmo there in at the motion picture home, and he would send me, I don't know why, he sent me some texts, and we started communicating back and forth, and so I stayed in touch with Cosmo through Dennis's visits, and feel really blessed and honored that I was able to kind of stay in touch with him near the end of his life. And he lived till his late 90s.
Yeah.
And and was a wonderful part of our Star Trek family. So yeah, this podcast has really reminded me of how fast time flies and how lucky we are to have had that opportunity, those 7 years of that show with such wonderful people. So
yeah, and I would have thought that Cosmo would have passed away earlier, because I remember on Voyager he was already so old at that point. I was like, you know, and he really outlived some other people who were younger than him that passed away, the crew, like Jerry Fleck, our wonderful first assistant director. We had two of them. We had Jerry, and we had, I've already blanked the other person's
Adele?
Name out of my head. Adele, yes, the incompetent
Adele Simmons.
One. I'm going to say that right now, the incompetent one. We had one really, really competent person, which was Jerry Fleck, and one not very competent person, which was
Adele. I would say that Jerry Fleck was a very seasoned veteran and certainly a reliable and stable personality on the Star Trek.
Okay.
Family. I think Adele was she was not quite as experienced as Jerry Fleck, and sometimes for us as actors, the first ADs we rely on for organization and reliability, and sometimes production is just not reliable. And so Adele was much more affected by the ups and downs of production. Jerry was able to keep a steady hand in spite of the challenges. But we really relied on Jerry, and I was there on Enterprise, the series Enterprise. I was directing when Jerry passed away. So I was there with the Star Trek family when he passed away. And we actually shut down the day that Jerry Fleck passed away, the first AD. We did not film that day. Scott Bakula and Mary Howard, myself, we all decided that the crew was so affected by Jerry's passing on Enterprise that we decided not to film. And by the way, when Gene Roddenberry passed away, they paused but continued filming that day. When Jerry Fleck passed away, they stopped filming.
They stopped.
Yeah. So it's a different kind of relationship the actors and the crew have with the onset, the front lines people. And people like David Graff, you know, to get back to this episode, David Graff, you know, an actor in our episode. And I didn't know that he had passed away so young and so long ago, but sad to hear.
Can I elaborate a little bit more? I'm a very blunt person, and I come out and I say what I want to say, right? And so when I say something about Adele not being competent, I need to elaborate and be very specific about this so I don't seem like I'm just slinging mud through the, you know, through the universe. Yeah. One of the principal jobs for a first AD is literally to schedule the day. Okay. They're sort of the ones that have to get in contact with us, the actors, to tell us, okay, since you're filming, you're not in the first, you know, half of the filming of this particular shooting day, but in the second half, we're not sure exactly what time, but so we will call you. It's called a we'll notify. Like, we'll notify at 1 p.m. We'll call you at 1 p.m. to tell you what time to come in later. Okay. Yes. And so then they'll say at 1 p.m. they're like, hey, you know, we're running behind, so come in at 4 p.m. That's your hair and makeup call.
Yeah.
Whenever Jerry Fleck gave us a call time after a will notify or any call time that's on a call sheet, it was always almost dead on in terms of the right time to call us in. With Adele, she'd say, okay, I'm going to bring you in at 2 p.m. And there were so many times that I would come in after what Adele told me, to the time that I was supposed to be there, and I would not see any action until 6, 7, 8 hours later. And that would infuriate me because she could never get that timing right. Okay.
Yeah. She was always airing. Adele would often air, because she was less experienced. I think Adele would air on, let's get them there hours early. And Jerry was much more respectful of actors, you know, human beings' lives. And he would try to be precise about his time. So
that's
true.
But she wasn't a newbie. She worked on other shows before this. Yeah. So my feeling is, you know, this is your job. Do it the best that you can. And I think that the way she did it really inconvenienced our lives, our schedules, everything. At some point later in this, I'm going to be talking a little bit more about the fateful day where I got in trouble with production.
Oh, let's get to that.
And a lot of it has to do with, not on this episode. we are not doing it on this episode. So when I get to it, I'm going to set a lot of things straight, because there's all types of rumors out there that they were planning on firing me because of all these things I had done on the set. And the only thing that saved me was that I was on People Magazine's 50 Most Beautiful People issue. And so they decided to fire Kes instead.
Wow.
There's all these type of crappy rumors out there that are not true. And I'm going to set this straight on this podcast when we get to the time that I...
Great. That I'm excited for that.
So you... Yeah. So
I'm looking forward to that episode.
If there's anything to
I don't
stay
know
tuned
when it
to.
Is, but I'm excited.
You're gonna,
all right, let's get back to the 37.
Let's get back to it. So we find that pickup truck in the middle of space. It's just floating
in space.
So what exactly happened is my question. So the Briori,
why did they leave?
Did the Briori capture, did they beam up everybody? And then there, maybe that one ship that was heading back to this planet that they're now on had some issues where they were like, okay, we've got too much weight. We're malfunctioning. We've got to ditch some weight. Let's get rid of the human.
It's very strange why that's floating.
Why
in
is
space.
It floating?
It makes no logical sense.
Because obviously the Briori didn't sort of make that truck into some type of spaceship and try to launch into space themselves. That thing is just floating in space. Now we've beamed it into the cargo hold, and as we see everyone walking around it, I was trying to make out. I was pausing and then rewinding, repausing back and forth to see the license plate. I think it says Ohio. It's tough because it says Ford, it says truck on there, but I think Ohio is also on
there. I want to say that Tom Paris came in 26 seconds into this episode. So
you
knew it was going to be a good episode.
You knew?
Yeah. I was like, okay, Tom Paris is, you know, the last episode, I think he was like 38 or 39 minutes.
Minutes, yeah. Which
into
is
the
literally
episode.
Almost the end
was,
of the episode.
Yeah, this was 36 seconds. I paused it. I was like, yes. No, I'm sorry, 26. I made a note. 26 seconds. So I thought it was going to be a really good episode.
Robbie,
that's all I got to say there.
I just want to share this with you.
Yes.
Yeah. Remember, I brought this up yesterday, the other day, when we were filming the last episode we did. And I said that someone had sent in this little YouTube video showing screen time. And it's a bar chart. And it just keeps moving around. I didn't tell you that a lot of it, Paris is near the bottom.
So I know.
I'm
not
gonna share that with you right now. So
I'm not surprised, honestly.
Okay.
I mean,
okay.
I felt like he, you know, he was not around for a lot. They didn't know what to do with Tom Paris. And this is the beginning. I love that this was the beginning of this idea of his 20th century knowledge when he was into the truck and he's walking around the truck and he's like, he knew about gasoline power.
Antique vehicles are a hobby of mine, is what you say.
Yes. I was very happy that maybe now, finally, the first episode of season two, they figured out something that'll give them a spark of creativity about this character.
Harry asked Tom, is this an early hover car? And then you say, you're about a century too early for that. So this is a 1936 Ford, and we're about a century too early. So we're talking about 2036, which is 16 years from now. So sometime from now until 2036. So the next 16 years, we should have a hover car.
Let's do it.
That's
Elon Musk.
Elon Musk, get on this, my friend.
Get on this, buddy.
This is the key. This is the key. You've got to follow this. This is written by Jerry Taylor and Brandon Braga. Directed by your favorite man, James L. Conway.
James L. Conway.
This is the first time that Jim Conway directs an episode of Voyager.
First one he directed of our show. He ended up directing the Enterprise pilot. So Jim Conway became a very important Star Trek director.
I did a little research into Jimmy Conway. He directed three TNGs, seven DS9. Four Voyagers and four Enterprise episodes. Oh. He also served as an executive vice president of Spelling Television.
He was a studio exec too.
Yeah. From 96 to 2002. And in 2012, believe it or not, he began writing novels. He wrote a novel called Dead and Not So Buried, another one called Sexy Babe, and a third novel called Cold Blonde. So this is interesting because now, you know, later in his directing of Voyager, you had a little bit of a confrontation with Mr. Conway.
I did have a little confrontation. We'll get to that when we get to that episode. But
we can do that. But it's over a reading of a book, and he ends up writing a book. So I think this was kind of like, wow, you know, I mean, Okay. Yeah. And we'll get to that when we get to that, I suppose. Yeah. Just like we'll get into my, see, we're giving like juicy teasers here to the fans.
Yes,
this
thing. Yes,
they're
we
wondering
are.
What was it about, you know, that happened with Garrett, and what was the conflict with Robbie McNeil and James Conway?
Yeah. I don't know if Jim Conway realized it was a conflict. I think it was more a grudge that I held about that moment, you know.
Just, I thought so too. I was thinking about that.
Probably
I always felt
more my grudge than his, but I felt a little bit.
You know what it was, Robbie? He called you out. He could have easily come up and just said something to you, but he called you out in front of the entire set, front of everybody, everybody, the crew, the actors. And it was basically, it was a third grade teacher talking to a student and kind of sternly, you know what I'm saying? And it's sort of like, I know you as who you are. You weren't a child at the time. You're a man. And to be spoken to as if you were a child is really just
that was
less than human.
Yeah, it was a moment, but we'll get to that in that episode.
Okay.
But we'll talk about that. But I did always like Jim Conway. I still like Jim Conway. I think he's a very interesting, creative person. I didn't know about all the novels. I know that Jim Conway has gone on to do a lot of photography, gallery photography, and he sold photographs in galleries and things like that. He directed also on the Orville. Jim Conway is a colleague and a very talented director. And
he's very talented.
He did a wonderful job with the Enterprise pilot, and this was his first episode of Voyager. So, this episode and how Jim directed it, I think. My memory was it was much bigger, like I said earlier.
Mm-hmm.
In looking at it today, it wasn't as big or epic as I remember.
Yeah.
Either directorially or from a writing standpoint or even from a story standpoint, it wasn't as profound as I remember. My general memory was like, wow, that was one of our big episodes, a special episode. And it didn't seem as big as I remembered. It was the first episode where we landed Voyager onto a planet surface. And so that was, you know, going to Blue Alert on the bridge. That was kind of a new thing. We'd never done that.
You're the best pilot anyone can have, but you've never landed a ship, though. So you were a novice in that. So when Janeway says, "Put her down, Mr. Paris," you have no comment. Instead of going, "Yes, ma'am," you were kind of nervous inside.
So yes.
You had no comment. And then you had to do this thing for the very first time.
Yeah.
Because at the very end of the show, when we're about to leave, she says all these things, Janeway says all these things to you, and you go, "Yes, ma'am." Like the confident "yes, ma'am" is there because you know how to take off.
Well, I think she even says when we finally land, when I land the ship and we're on the planet's surface, she says, "Not bad for a beginner."
Right.
So it was the first time.
Yeah. And you did a great job because we didn't die. So you actually landed the ship. So we're very proud of you to do that the first time. But that look that Kim gives when he looks up to say that, he says it all. It's sort of like, you've never landed this ship before, or you don't know how to land a ship. It's kind of,
That was a big deal. That was a big deal in terms of the writers and kind of making a choice to land the ship was a pretty, from a series standpoint, a big deal. I was disappointed I didn't go with you guys to this location. Where did you film the exteriors of this? Do you remember?
Bronson Caves.
It was Bronson? Oh.
Yeah, it was Bronson. So we're not too far away. You didn't miss much. I mean, you've been there before.
You know?
I have a question for you. When you're in the truck and you're about to start it up and you're looking for the key, where did you find the key? Because it almost looked like you found the key in the ignition.
It looked like it was just sitting there.
And then did you also notice that truck's all beat up, rusted, and those keys are brand spanking new? Did you notice that? Yeah. If you look at the keys, they're completely
funny.
There's no rust on those keys. They were just, it's almost like those were keys that they just cut. They just cut those keys right before they filmed that particular scene. That's brand new. Yeah, there's no corrosion whatsoever. And there's a set of two. So you see one key and it's in the ignition, the other one's dangling down, and there's no corrosion. Completely pristine. The truck backfires, right? You hear the backfiring when you're starting the truck. Now, this to me was really comical because
nobody knows what it is.
Well, see, nobody should have. Janeway and Torres, they duck.
Yep.
Why are they ducking? They shouldn't have ducked. This should just be a loud noise. You know, we should be startled. But there shouldn't be this ducking thing, which is what we would do in the 20th.
And Tuvok pulls out his phaser. He pulls out his phaser.
Exactly. Yeah. So everyone else is reacting as if they are living in 1995, right? They're doing this 1995 reaction. I just want to bring up this little just quick story. I remember watching on TV, they were televising like a high school championship football game. And at the end, there was like, I think there were some military people there, and they either did like a 21 gun salute or something at the very end of the game. But the players were on the field, and once all the rifles went off, every inner city kid hit the deck, just hit the deck. Whereas all the white suburban football players, they kept standing because, again,
right,
nurture nature. When you're raised in a suburban white neighborhood, you're not used to gunfire and you're not used to taking cover. But if you're raised in Watts or Compton, you're going to take cover when you hear a gunshot, because that's how you save your life. You know, you don't get hit by a stray bullet. And so I just remember seeing that so clearly in my head, watching that football game, thinking, wow, look at the difference between
the difference in the reaction, the context,
yeah, the reaction of, yes, the context. And then it's the same thing. Why the hell would you, as a director, why would Jim Conway tell Janeway and Torres, you guys got to duck? Like, you know, they're not going to know what that is going to sound like. We don't have that type of
thing. Yeah. It's funny. I thought it was a comical moment in a good way that everybody ducked but I see your point. Yeah. To me, it was, I was like, I always, whenever on our show there's a funny moment or a lighthearted moment, I'm very relieved. I love seeing it. I love seeing the sense of humor from characters, from our own characters, from guest stars. In the last episode, Shell, that character, the blue guy, I thought he was hilarious. I wish we could have kept him around. I love seeing these comical moments. So to me, when that happened, the backfire happened, and Janeway ducked down, and Tuvok pulls the phaser, I just went with it of like, oh, that's funny. They don't know what a backfire is. They think it's a gunshot, but you're right. They wouldn't know a gunshot because they're not familiar with it.
When we go down on the planet and we come up upon Amelia Earhart's plane, I'm guessing that was her plane, you know?
Yeah.
It's very weathered except for one portion, the hub of the propeller, the very end of that little, the center part of the propeller.
Oh, it's kind of shiny.
It's shiny. It's like, what? It's like, what is going on here? And it's like the keys from the pickup, super shiny. The end of that. So I feel these are things that, like, which part of the production team should have been responsible for that? Would it be props?
That would have been the art department. So production,
art department.
Art department, set design.
Yeah.
Our on-set decorating crew would have been responsible for that.
Yeah, so they missed
That's the kind of thing, when you're when I'm directing, even though there are departments that should think about all these things, when you're out there actually about to roll camera, that's when the director has to be looking at all of that.
Okay.
And go, you know, not just the director, but the ADs and the script supervisor and everybody. Yeah. And so when things like that happen, shiny keys or shiny propellers, It means that a number of people just weren't paying attention to that.
Okay.
They were more focused on other things.
There's multiple fail safes beyond the set design, the property, I mean, the art department that should have caught that. The first AD should have saw that. The director should have saw that, right?
Yeah, so somebody should have said, hey, that's really shiny. Let's dull that down or put some dirt on it or something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that happens all the time. On sets when you're doing a scene, you know, that somebody will catch it. You hope that the director sees it, or the script supervisor, or the writer if they're on set, or you know, the art department, someone from props or somewhere on set decorating. There's a lot of people that should be looking at that, but they're looking at 1,000 things.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes I will overlook the most obvious. And it's funny, when I'm directing a show, sometimes someone will come up and say, hey, you know, that propeller is really shiny. Do you want to dull that down? And I'll think like, God, of course, now that you point it out, it's totally obvious. But no one, because we're looking at 1,000 things, you don't notice the one thing that's right in front of your face.
And so,
you know, this is centuries later. Janeway meets Amelia Earhart and knows everything about her. And it seemed strange to me. It just seemed convenient that she happened to know all of this.
Right.
Right. Or at least the way it was laid out in the script.
Yeah. I also felt that the 37s, if they were so revered by the human descendants, why didn't they keep that glass enclosure clean? We find them, just gotta rub all that dirt off. And I know that Rubenstein talks, his character talks about, we haven't been in there in generations inside there. I'm like, well, if you guys really sit here and worship these guys, why wouldn't you have maintenance crews come in there and upkeep that interior of that, you know, that chamber? I don't know.
Yeah, I also felt like, you know, Janeway, before we open the doors, Janeway's like, well, should we do this? Should we not do this? And she's like, you know, if we really want to figure out a way to go home, you know, maybe we should. And Tom Paris says, open it up. And I felt like there was a moment of warp part. I could have had a warp particles moment with her.
That was
like, why didn't they have the back and forth with Janeway and Paris going, and what about this? And then this, and then yes. And open the doors, wake them up.
I kind of
wanted a warp particles moment.
That should be your do-over.
All right, fine. That's going to be my do-over.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Do you remember when we were opening them up and then we have to grab the hypo sprays from Kes, right? So Kes, because we open up the doors and we were going to wake them simultaneously. So you walk first and Kes hands a hypo spray to you and you kind of look at her and you grab it. I don't even look at Kes or the hypo spray. It's like a no look pass in the NBA. I'm like, cool. Like that. I walk past and grab it. It is cool looking, but I also feel like maybe I was a victim of the repetitiveness of our industry, which is we film the same scene over and over again.
I thought it was cool. I felt like we were like, you know, we were in sync there
on a mission.
Yeah, yeah, I bought that.
We were very teamy, especially when Noonan pulls out the gun. Both you and I, boom, right? We had the phasers out in a second.
By the way, Noonan pulls out an old 20th century gun.
That
may not even work. We got six phasers on him and somehow he's able to disarm all of us with these phasers. And we're just like, sure, we'll hand over our phasers that he would not even know what hit him.
Exactly. Yeah, that's the thing. The speed of which we would have taken him out with that phaser would have been faster than his reaction time to pull the trigger to shoot Janeway. You see what I'm saying? So we both agree on that. That was a little bit of a hole in the script.
I did not buy that he disarmed us with the old revolver in his hand. No.
Yeah. I didn't buy that either. That was kind of a bummer.
Yeah.
And in this episode, when we wake them up, it's the first explanation of the universal translator in our series, right?
That's true.
Because James Saito's character comes around and says, wait, you're all speaking Japanese. And no, you're speaking English. And we realize it's the universal translator, which is built into our comm badge. And that's something that is a given throughout all of Star Trek series that a lot of people who watch Star Trek for the first time are always kind of scoffing at, like, well, how come that alien speaks English? And they kind of look down upon our stuff. And I think what's because you don't know about the universal translator,
which
is a convenient writer's, tool to make sure that we speak English. Yeah. How do you pronounce the word A-T-O-L-L? Sharon Lawrence, her character talks about looking to make a landing on the
atoll.
I say atoll as well. She said atoll.
Really?
Atoll. Yeah, she pronounced it atoll. And I was like, what the heck? I thought it was atoll. So,
do you remember in our script, so for those of you, if we haven't talked about this, we would get our scripts each week and there would be a pronunciation guide page early on in our script. You remember that?
Yeah.
That would have like the alien race and alien words and anything.
So any technobabble.
Technobabble, so that we were all speaking with the same pronunciation of any, you know, made up words.
Right.
And so in the script, when you first turn the page, it has the title page of the script. Mm-hmm. You turn the page, it's got the character list. Turn the page, it's got a set list. You turn the page and it's got a pronunciation page, which is not normal. Most shows do not have that. Most normal TV shows don't have a pronunciation guide. Yeah. So,
And evidently the pronunciation guide excluded Atoll. Yeah, yes. It wasn't in there. And it doesn't, and also it doesn't have censors in there because Tim Russ's pronunciation of censors and our censor is a little bit off too. But that was nice and interesting and unique that we had a pronunciation guide. That's correct.
Yeah. I thought it was a really awkward love confession, by the way, when
when Noonan tells her.
Noonan's in the sick bay. And he's like, I love you. I love you. I just want you to know. And then he's fine. He's like, forget everything I said. Forget I said that. He was very funny.
Oh, my God. I also noticed when I'm walking into the Emilia's plane for the first time to check out that signal. The makeup, it was just packed on. I had so much makeup on my face. It just,
really?
We used, the makeup artists all used this pancake heavy makeup. And that day was very heavy. I just looked like just way too much. You know? I mean, I think there's a fine line between how much makeup you can put on an actor's face and not look like makeup, right? You have to be a little bit, you have to.
Star Trek was never known to be a subtle makeup or hair show. You know, the wigs, the buns of steel, all of that was pretty heavy-handed.
Right.
I did feel like it was a bummer that we sort of glossed over this series point where this revolt of the slaves of the 37s, the slave revolt that turned away the Briori, the race that had abducted them. They could have been an opportunity for us to get home. And we didn't really explore that much. It was like, well, you guys, you know, this revolt that you had turned away the Briori, but where are the Briori? Where, you know, we need to find the Briori because that's a way to get home. They abducted you guys.
Yes, they talked about the ship was completely destroyed, that the Briori had, you know, that they rebelled against. So we don't know anything more about the Briori. And I felt like
for series, like Janeway should have been on that immediately of like, wait a minute, the Briori, let's tell us everything you know about the Briori. Where can we find them? Are they close by? Is there any way that we can contact them? Any of that, because that would have gotten us home. But instead we sort of focused on this, there's humans on this planet. Should we just give up our attempt to go home and just settle here? That became the focus. We didn't deal with the fact that we had an opportunity, a connection, if we had done the work to try to contact the Briori, find the Briori. I don't remember us ever bringing up the Briori in another episode. But
no, we didn't. And I really, as a fan watching this episode, I was really just wanting to see an image of the Briori. I want to see what they look like. I want to know more about who these people are. But all they did was refer to them in expositional lines, and that was it. We didn't see anything else with them. And so that was a missed opportunity and a loose end for sure.
I also found that when John Rubenstein's character, he says, you know, we've got three beautiful cities 50 miles from here. When he said miles, I was like, wait a minute, how do you know miles? Like, you guys, how did you get, you know, 100,000 people or whatever, however many humans there are now, whose children are they? Are they Amelia Earhart's children? Like, who had the children that became this new race of humans? Where, who are you related to? Which of these humans that were abducted?
none of the ones in the stasis tubes, obviously. I think it was the other, because they said they abducted like 300 or 400 humans in 1937. So some of them were not put in stasis tubes. And why some were and why some weren't, that was never answered. So we don't know that. So obviously the ones that were used as slaves that were not in stasis tubes became the the forefathers of the current 15th generation of humans that were still alive on that planet.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of backstory that they could have really gone into and explored, but it was a victim of the 43 minute constraint that we have to deal with.
It's hard to squeeze in everything we want. You know, it's easy to go back and, like we're doing, and rewatch these episodes and look for all the things that we wish were in there. And I'm sure the fans feel the same way. Like,
yes,
you know, they want to know what happened between the scenes that are on the show. But
I like how when we were being held hostage by Noonan, you sit there and you say, "He's had a few nips from that flask, Captain. Maybe we could probably rush him and get the gun." So you say this, and I'm going, "That's so funny, because Robbie McNeil had a few nips from his flask before we did this podcast."
It was a summer day and I was out by the pool. It was
I'm not
nice.
Judging you, man. I'm just saying it's pretty awesome that you know, you can rush me
if you want.
I'm gonna gang tackle you from thousands of miles away. But I just think it's pretty awesome that how coincidental
that's funny.
The one episode where your character says, because you never ever refer to anybody drinking, I don't think ever again in this series.
Probably not.
But you do it in here, talking about a few nips from the flask. And our conversation in the pre-production meeting was, "I've had a few daytime cocktails. You've had a few adult beverages. You know, it's a great day. My yard looked great. I decided to drink a little bit. And, you know, I'm going to need to sober up a little bit before we do this podcast." So I just thought it was awesome that your character said that. You happened to be drinking.
I got a question for you. So Janeway says at one point, she says that we have 152 men and women on Voyager.
Yeah, she does.
Is that the consistent number that we always talked about? I feel like we talked about a lot of different numbers of crew members on Voyager.
That's a new number for me. I always felt, I knew that the crew complement, meaning how many it's supposed to hold, was 170 something. Okay. So I always thought we had 170 something.
Plus the Maquis that we took on board. Like, I thought we had more.
Then maybe it would be more. But and through time, obviously, we lose people from, you know,
we have
casualties and stuff.
Sure.
Yeah. But we're so early. We're still pretty early. How do we have 150? Doesn't seem right.
It seemed wrong to me too. I'd be curious. Maybe the fans can kind of track this a little and see if numbers are brought up again, because 152 seems small to me.
Yeah, this is like the numbers episode, right? So 152 crew complement. About 100 years before the first hover car comes out,
and we actually talk about 300 people on the planet.
Yeah, 300 on the planet.
There's a lot of math in this episode.
There is. Kim says Mars was colonized by Earth in 2103. So that number's thrown out there. It's a lot of numbers. It's a math episode.
Did you notice the lighting? Because the ship was landed on the planet's surface, when Janeway was in her ready room and some of those scenes where we had blue sky outside.
Yes.
We never have blue sky outside. We always had space outside.
Yeah,
it's kind of very different to see these rooms with blue sky outside and the lighting, the sunlight coming in on her face, I thought was really beautiful. It was a nice change and just a little detail that I enjoyed seeing in those scenes.
I also feel that the capability to land, I think this may be the first starship to do that. Maybe.
Really?
I mean, I don't recall any other starships with struts and, you know, landing like that, you know? So I feel like that was a big deal when we were talking about this episode.
I just got to say, as we get into the episode and we're watching it at this point, the idea of the crew members staying on this planet and not going home came up.
Yeah.
I just found it hard to believe that our crew members, any of our crew members, I wasn't surprised when Janeway walks into the cargo bay and nobody's there to stay. I wasn't surprised. I was like, why would anybody? I mean, honestly, I think this would have been a better episode if each of the crew members, Tuvok and Kim and Paris and B'Elanna Torres, every character had a scene or a moment or a little place where they were talking, where they considered staying and argued for why maybe I should stay here, because I'd never got invested in this idea that the crew was going to stay on this planet. And that
Have two scenes though, Robbie, the scene with Chakotay and Janeway talking about whether or not to stay.
Are the crew going to stay? But we never saw the crew actually saying, hey, here's why I think it might be a good idea to stay.
Well, you saw Harry and B'Elanna talk about it, right?
Briefly,
Harry
and B'Elanna. Very briefly.
Because the beginning of that scene, it was basically B'Elanna saying, you're thinking about staying? I'm just feel like it reminds me of home and stuff like that. You're right. It would have been nice to see everybody react to that and have this dilemma between whether or not to stay or not. But again,
to me, it would have been interesting though, if when she opened that door, if we felt like any one of these many characters which one of these characters is going to decide to stay, and none of them did. I never believed that Harry was going to stay. I never believed that Tom, that anyone that we cared about.
Okay.
In fact, Baxter and Jarvin, who the hell are Jarvin and Baxter? No one's ever heard of them. Again, we're talking about characters that the audience has never heard of, that they're never going to care about. And I'm like...
But then that's why I expected to see the people that you never see, a few of them, in the cargo bay. I felt that a few non-essentials.
But nobody cares about them. That's what I'm saying.
I understand
that. That's the whole point I'm saying. Like, if they had been talking in a number of scenes about Tuvok's going to stay, he really wants to stay here, or Paris is going to stay, or Harry Kim is going to, he really misses Earth so badly. And even though he wants to see his family, he wants to connect with humans here. If there had been a buildup, but Baxter and Jarvin, I'm just confused. I don't know who they are, and I don't care who they are, honestly.
I hear you. Yeah. I hear you. I believe in that. But again, when you're handcuffed by a 42-minute time limit of an episode because you got to put commercials in, you can't really deal with that. If the episode was 1 hour or hour 10 minutes of screen time, yes, you're going to have the buildup. And so the writers, I bet they felt, okay, this episode with Kim and Torres, that'll help set it up for people to be invested in this. Yeah. And the conversation that Janeway and Chakotay have as they're walking down the corridor to the cargo bay, specifically talking about people that they really think are going to stay because of, blah, blah, blah. Well, that's going to give people the feeling that, because I did believe as a viewer, as a fan, that at least somebody was going to be in that cargo bay. And the fact that nobody was, that was the feel good moment. That was the tear jerker moment for the audience, seeing Janeway. And I really wish they let her shed a damn tear. You know what I'm saying? They cut that crap out. They were like, nope, can't have Janeway being emotional. She's got to be tough as nails.
Did you see Chakotay's hand on her shoulder though?
No, I didn't.
Just before the door opens, he says something like, no matter what happens, we'll be okay. And he puts his hand on her shoulder. I was like, oh, that's provocative. That's a little foreshadowing of Janeway and Chakotay
relationship.
Yeah. It's a nice, intimate little hand on the shoulder moment.
See, that's a good thing that there are two of us doing this, because you will catch moments that I will not catch.
Right.
I will catch shiny keys that you will not catch.
That's right.
So, this is important. Let's go back a little bit to when we're exiting the cave and Noonan gets shot. And so in the script, Kim is the one to go over and drag him out of there. Now, in theory, that's great. Yes, it's very simple. Kim goes to Noonan, who's injured by the gunfire, the phaser fire, and drags him to safety.
Yep.
David Graff is a 6'3", definitely 200, I'm guessing 240 maybe, I mean, he was a big guy.
He's a big guy.
And I remember when I grabbed him from underneath the arms and just tried to pull, couldn't move him at all, like not even an inch. And I was, and I'm not a small man either. I'm 5'11". It's funny thing is, when I meet people at conventions, they always say, wow, you're taller than I thought. Because typically in Hollywood, let's face it, if you meet Sylvester Stallone,
Tom Cruise,
these guys are all 5'7", 5'8". That's it. Okay.
Yeah.
So when they meet me at 5'11", they're like, damn, like you're taller than we thought. Because guess what? Robbie McNeil is taller than I am. Tim Russ is taller than I am. And all the other guys, we have tall guys on our show.
Yeah, we did.
The only short man that we have is Ethan Phillips. He's the only short guy. Everybody else is tall. Tuvok's tall. Chakotay's tall. The doctor's tall. Everybody's tall. So, but even at 5'11", and And at 20, whatever, 6 years old I was at that time, 25 years old, dragging a 6'3", 200 plus pound man was impossible. So you see then in that take, he had to use his legs to shuffle, right? He's pushing on his legs.
Right.
He was using his legs to help propel himself backwards while I'm dragging him because he was so heavy. And I told Jim Conway, I was like, there's no way. Because he's like, can you do this faster? I go, no, I can't pull him any. I mean, literally, I'm pulling him and he's going like an inch a minute.
Well, it's funny, in television or film, often writers will write things like that. Like, you know, this character runs over and throws him over his shoulder and pulls him away from danger.
Yeah.
And you're like, that's physically not as easy as you just wrote it.
Exactly. Like,
physically, yeah. For a human being, a real live human being, to go do that is hard. Yeah. I remember in the last episode, Chakotay went up and grabbed the young Bajoran kid in the cargo bay and had to carry him down some stairs. And I thought, wow, that must have been stuntmen there because you can't just throw somebody over your shoulder and carry them across a room. It's not easy, especially for an actor, to do. That's a stunt. That's a stuntman thing.
For sure.
Yeah.
So now we're taking fire. Not only are we taking fire, but the away team, the security detail has come to sort of save us, which is led by Chakotay. He's under fire in a different area.
Yeah.
And Janeway, you know, on her combat, she says,
Janeway to Chakotay, I can see you from here. Lay down phaser fire. I'm going to circle around to your left. Try to come at them from the rear.
Now, this is when she runs away from us. You only see a little split reaction of her running, but it's a very awkward run. And this was something, this is something like this, because you weren't there in this scene, but in this particular scene, they omitted some of the footage, okay? Because you just see her kind of creeping away, but it's a very awkward run. But her actual run, which Conway does have footage of her kind of running off into the bush.
Yeah.
It was so unathletic looking. And I talk about this at conventions, and I actually imitate this run. I've done this image, and I apologize to Kate, but it's for airing this dirty laundry, but you don't know how to run. You just don't. I mean, it's just like, it's this really awkward sort of like, and I do it on stage at conventions. And then I tell the fans after that day, in filming the 37s, never again do you see Janeway running. It's always Chakotay, run over there. It's like she's telling everybody else That's to run funny. After this, because I'm sure the writers are watching the dailies and saying, oh my gosh, no, that's the captain?
It's funny how different actors just have a natural, like I have a very Frankenstein kind of run. I know that. I've known it since I was a younger act before Star Trek. Like, and I'm very self-conscious of it, honestly. I'm very, like when I used to run, I'm not a good runner. I was not a runner in high school. I was not, running was not my athletic thing. And so my run is very Frankenstein-y, and I try to, and because I'm aware of it, because it's been pointed out to me before, when I run, I really try to like make it a little more graceful. but it's funny, like writers will write things and every actor's got just certain, you know, built in, burned in, baked in kind of qualities that are their strengths and some are not their strengths. And that I wasn't aware of that, but maybe, athletic stuff is not Kate's strength.
Well, I'm going to say this. I'm going to say the majority, the large percentage of actors, if you talk about them being the more artistic type, when they were in high school, they were doing drama then. They're not on any athletic team. They're doing drama. You know what I'm saying? So they don't have, I would say 80% of actors are uncoordinated.
They're not athletic.
They're not athletic. Robert Beltran, Chakotay, was the captain and quarterback of his football team in high school. So he's very athletic. I'm not boasting, but I come from a long line of, like, my grandmother was a tennis champion in college. My grandfather was pentathlete. My parents are very they have no athletic ability, but I think it skips generations. So I played a lot of sports, you know. So I when I saw Kate running that day, I was literally like, oh no. I mean, it was, I've never honestly, I mean, Rob, if you think about it, watching somebody run shouldn't be cringeworthy. But that day, I was like, oh, no, 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 no. I almost thought it was a joke. I thought Kate was going to turn around,
just kidding, everybody. I don't really run like that. I run like this.
And then she would do a Jamie Summers Bionic Woman really cool run.
Right.
She didn't do that. It was the most awkward, uncoordinated thing that I'd ever seen. And I felt
That's
so
the magic
mad.
Of filmmaking is you can like, cut all that stuff out and make anybody, you make anybody look good, even me. Make me look good.
I've never, you know what? It's interesting that you say you have a Frankenstein plodding type of a gait. I've never known that you were you were that like, okay.
Yeah, I'm so, I'm a little self-conscious about it.
When this pandemic's over, I think
we're gonna go for a run.
We should go for a run and we should film ourselves running to show all the fans what we're doing, you know?
Okay.
And again, I apologize to Kate, but I mean, it's the God honest truth. I was really just mortified to watch her do that run. And I feel bad that I've told people over the years at convention about it, but it's the truth. And I tend to put my foot in my mouth and just say whatever I'm going to say. And that was-
Yes, you do.
That was one of the things.
I will
yes,
agree.
I do.
Yes, you do.
All right.
So coming off of the last couple episodes, and I know those were not intended to be the end of season one, but they were very disappointing episodes. And then my memory of this episode was that it was much bigger and more cinematic and more grand and epic. And I was very disappointed. This was not intended to be a season premiere. Again, it started off good with our whole cast involved in the story, but it just became filled with plot holes and missed opportunities. And I was not thrilled about this episode.
I want to bring up your reaction when Janeway shows up on the bridge after she and Chakotay have left the cargo bay and discovered no Voyager crew members are there.
Yeah.
They show up on the bridge and Tuvok makes the captain on the bridge comment and everyone stands up. So you see
And I
Janeway.
Covered my butt. I covered my butt. I don't know if you noticed, but I turned around and covered my butt.
You put your hands behind your
back. I
don't know if you're covering your bum. But then it shows your coverage, your reaction to Janeway looking at you. And you do this really interesting little smirky smile where the right half of your face smiles and then the left half smiled up. So it's like typically when people smile, both sides go up. But you did a right side and then a left side. Like you had independent control of your facial muscles. And I don't know if you caught that or not. So I'd like you to go back and take a look at that. I wrote that down. I go, Paris on bridge smiles on the right and left side of his face. So he's got
independent control.
Independent control. Yeah.
A very specific actor.
You are. Yes.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What is what's your take on the underlying message out of this one?
That, you know, the 37s and some new planet is like a step backwards and we're headed home. Like that's now.
Okay.
Like the thing for our crew and our ship is we are on our path. We may not like it, but that's the path we're on. And we've got to stay here and now and not try to go back and live in some 1930s Earth, some planet that has, you know, no problems, these brand new cities or whatever. You can't go back. You got to stay where you are. So yeah, that's my theme.
So stay in the present, move forward, not live in the past, not go backwards.
That was my theme. Yeah. Well, what about you?
This one was a little tougher for me to find an underlying message, to be perfectly honest. I was sitting there going, because maybe I was also equally underwhelmed as you were, like thinking, oh, this is going to be an amazing app. And then, oh, wait a minute, not as big as I thought it was going to be.
Yeah.
Right. So then I was sitting here struggling with that. But then I do remember one particular bit of dialogue between Janeway and I think it was Chakotay, where she was talking about how interesting how when after they had toured the cities or the settlements of these humans on this planet, how similar they had evolved to our civilization on Earth. Yeah. And she said, she goes, it's remarkable. You know, our civilizations are thousands of light years away, but we both evolved to the point where there is no war and no poverty. War and poverty do not exist. Yeah. So really, again, I think it's that message that this is what we need to strive for. You know, yeah. As a society, we need to be definitely more utopian than dystopian. We need to think about eliminating armed conflict, eliminating poverty. You know, nobody should be having to want, need, you know, food and shelter. That should be provided. You know, that should happen. And nobody should be killing anybody else. You know, that's for sure. So, so really, the underlying message for me was really that particular dialogue between her and Chakotay.
That's a very optimistic and very,
it is.
Yes, a very positive message. I like that. I like it. Nice.
You like that?
Yeah.
Well, thank you to everybody out there listening to the Delta Flyers podcast, our discussion and analysis of the 37s. Stay tuned next week when we will be discussing and analyzing Initiations, the next episode. And Robbie, do we have a special guest on that next episode?
I think we do have a very special guest, and it's a special episode for us in a lot of ways. So I hope everybody can tune in for it. Yeah.
There you go. We're going to have a nice time with a special guest. So exciting. All right, guys. Live long and prosper. Mm-hmm.